From the KGOU studios, I'm Sam Dupre, one of the show's producers and a graduate of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. And welcome to Worldviews. Financial advisor Hamid Biglari left Iran for the United States in 1977. In the following decades, Iran's economy collapsed as a result of sanctions and, more recently, falling oil prices.
Iran has lost about $135 billion, but it's going to lose even more. So it's a double whammy effect.
Although sanctions have been lifted following a nuclear deal, Biglari says Iran still has problems that need solving in order to generate foreign investment and rebuild its economy.
Minority investor rights, contract and dispute resolution, those mechanisms are not sufficiently well developed.
Joshua Landis will talk with Hamid Biglari about Iran's role in the world economy and global politics, right after this hour's news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Sam Dupre, sitting in this week for Suzette Gerlot. I've been a producer of the show for the past year and a half. Our guest is Hamid Biglari, a managing partner at the TGG Group, a financial advisory firm for Fortune 100 companies. Biglari has also worked with Citibank, and last year Bloomberg News called him Iranian President Hassan Rouhani's go-to guy in New York financial circles. He spoke with our contributor, Joshua Landis.
Hamid Biglari, welcome to Worldviews.
My pleasure. Nice to be with you, Josh.
Let me begin talking about Iran today. Explain to us why Iran is important.
So there are several reasons for Iran's geopolitical and geoeconomic importance. The first is that it is the 18th largest economy in the world in terms of purchasing power parity. Its GDP on that basis is about $1.4 trillion, which makes it about 8% the size of the U.S. economy. It has a population of about 80 million people. And I like to say that Iran is the only G20 country that is not part of the G20. It has been disconnected from the world economy for an extended period of time. And I think that we may be at an inflection point in terms of that interaction. The second reason for Iran's importance is it has a highly educated population. It's one of the most interesting statistics on that front is that Iran puts out about the same number of engineering graduates every year as the United States, about 240,000, which puts it fourth in the world after India, China, and the United States. And that is remarkable because all of these countries have many times the population of Iran. So it's a population that is technically savvy. About two-thirds of the population is below the age of 35. And that population is extremely well educated. They are internet connected to the rest of the world. And it's a great foundation to build. And the third reason for Iran's importance is that it is the largest it has the largest hydrocarbon reserves in the world. And it is the fourth largest oil reserves in the world after Venezuela, Saudi Arabia, and Canada. And it is the largest, it holds the largest gas reserves in the world. And on a combined basis, there are very few economies that are balanced between both oil and gas. So, for example, Saudi Arabia has a lot of oil, very little gas, and Qatar has a lot of gas, very little oil. Iran is perhaps the only major energy-producing economy that is balanced across both. And yet, despite that, only about a quarter of the economy is based on oil and gas. And this is surprising because most resource-intensive economies are much more heavily composed. They have an economy that is much more heavily composed of energy. So in the case of Saudi Arabia, about half the GDP is oil. In the case of Russia, it's about 35 to 40%. So for Iran to be a quarter of the GDP means that it has a much more diversified economy than it would suggest, and that is despite the fact that it's been under sanctions and having to create a foundation without the benefit of lots of interaction with the world. So all of those are reasons for its relative importance in the world's economy.
So as Iran, now that there is this nuclear deal and sanctions are lifted, investors are swarming and looking at Iran, what do they see? Those are the strengths. What are the weaknesses of Iran?
So there are several weaknesses. The most important would be what one could characterize as rule of law, investor protection, minority investor rights, contract and dispute resolution. Those mechanisms are not sufficiently well developed, and they need to be much more developed before Iran can handle a significant level of foreign direct investment. Doing business in Iran is not easy, and one needs to put that in context of other emerging markets. And the World Bank does a very good job in terms of looking across various elements of doing business and tabulating countries. So right now, Iran, out of 190 countries, by the World Bank's reckoning, is somewhere on the order of 120 or 130 in the world. So it's towards the bottom quartile. But if you actually, as I reflect now, it's more like 118th in the world. Russia is 50th, just so you have a benchmark. India is 130th, and Brazil is about 116. So despite the fact that that number may look bad, Brazil is about the same as Iran in terms of the ability to do business, and India is worse. And if you look at the various elements of what makes it difficult to do business in Iran, one of the most challenging is corruption, the level of corruption, the fact that you need to feed a lot of different hands in terms of getting something done. And then there's the various elements of dispute resolution, how long it takes to register property, all of those various factors. And it's a sign of the fact that it's not truly a market economy. There's a lot of state intrusion that needs to be changed. And the third area where Iran has a lot of room to grow is capital allocation is relatively inefficient. And that has to do with the fact that the banking system is not well developed. And for much of the previous administration, the Ahmadinejad administration, bank interest rates were set by the state, and they were set at irrational levels to promote populist policies. And so the nature of bank intermediation, which is to take money from borrowers and to take money from savers and give it to borrowers, was broken because the rates weren't set by market supply and demand. They were set by the state, and that made it much more challenging. As a result of which, there's a large amount of non-performing loans that has accumulated because the financial intermediation has been broken for so long, and that needs to be fixed, and Iran needs to have a more independent central bank that makes monetary decisions and regulatory issues. So those are some of the challenges.
Let's talk about oil for a second. As you've said, Iran is a monster in the overall global oil markets. It's been producing at a very low rate because of sanctions, because there hasn't been capital investment. Oklahomans, who are very worried about the price of oil being so low and has dealing a really devastating blow to our economy, they're looking at Iran today because Iran doesn't seem to want to play ball with Saudi Arabia, Russia, and others who said that they're willing to freeze the production side because Iran says, look, we've got to get our market share back. We've got economy to build. We've just come out of sanctions. What's the likely impact of Iran on oil pricing in the next few years?
Yeah. Well, that's a very important question, Josh, obviously. It's worth just taking a step back. And if you look at what has happened to Iran, since sanctions were imposed, and you separate from that two dynamics. One, the fact that sanctions were in place that caused Iran to go to half of its export capacity from around 2.5 million barrels per day down to 1.1 million barrels per day. And then you add to that the fact that oil prices collapsed in the last year or so to the levels that we see them today. If you ask the question, how much did Iran lose purely as a result of the sanctions being in place? And how much is Iran losing from the fact that oil collapsed from, let's say, in the 70s now down to the 30s? It turns out that Iran has lost about $135 billion just from the fact that it wasn't able to produce as much as it did post-sanctions. But it's going to lose over the next 5 years about $180 billion from the fact that oil prices are, if you look at, I'm not saying that based on futures prices for oil, which is expected to remain on a global basis, not get much higher than, or projected to be much higher than about $45, $50 a barrel, even by 2020. It will lose even more than what it lost during sanctions. So it's a double whammy effect.
And Iran produced about 6 million barrels under the Shah, didn't it?
It did. At its in 1979, before the Shah collapse, Iran was producing 6 million and was exporting a sizable portion of that.
Could Iran produce 6 million again? Now, it's a very mature, of course, field. 1908 began producing oil, feeding the British Navy and so forth. So a lot of those fields are cost a lot to get the oil out because they're mature. What is the potential for Iranian oil if things worked right, there were capital investments, so forth?
Well, it's there are two sides to that question. One is the fact that because of a lack of investment in oil-producing technology, Iran's yield from its oil fields have been drastically reduced from what they should be and what they could be, as a result of which extraction hasn't actually been as much as it could have been had Iran been operating with efficient technology. Experts believe that, first of all, Iran needs on the order of $200 billion of new investment just to bring its technology up to world standards over the next 5 to 10 years. And even with that, in light of just general supply and demand balance in the world, it is unlikely that it will be able to get back anywhere near to its production level and its market share in terms of exports. So experts believe that by 2020, it will get back to roughly where it was before sanctions set in terms of export capacity, just by virtue of supply and demand and technological limitations. So we're pretty far away from it getting back to where it was pre-revolution.
That's Hamid Bigladi, a business consultant who has helped generate foreign investment in Iran following the lifting of sanctions by the West. We'll hear more of his conversation with Joshua Landis after a short break. I'm Sam Dupre, and this is Worldviews. Welcome back to Worldviews. I'm Sam Dupre, filling in this week for Suzette Gerlot. We've been hearing from Iranian-American financier Hamid Bigladi about the challenges of stabilizing Iran's economy following the lifting of sanctions. Before the break, he described the difficulties of bringing Iran's oil production back up to pre-revolution levels. He's been speaking with our contributor, Joshua Landis.
Let me switch the topic now to geostrategic questions. One of the big clouds hanging over Iran is that over the last 30 years, Iran has been demonized, and it's been in a struggle with the United States, with Saudi Arabia, with the Sunni world. And Iran's been painted as a terrorist state and an aggressive state that has been destroying the status quo in the Middle East. Iran has been building an architecture, a security architecture, that stretches from Lebanon with the growth of Hezbollah and the Shiite power, emergence of Shiite power in Lebanon, but also supporting Bashar al-Assad in Syria. Of course, America put the Shiites at the top of Iraq, and that's been very beneficial to Iran. But there is this architecture of what the king of Jordan called the Shiite Crescent, stretching from Lebanon through Syria, Iraq, Iran. How frightening should that security architecture be? It cuts the Sunni world in half. Russia is an ally, in a sense, both in Syria and in this strategic arc. How frightening should that be to Americans? And is it likely to harm America or not?
So another complex question, Josh. I think it's always helpful to look at the other side of the equation, because obviously we as the United States have a lot of grievances with respect to Iran, starting from the taking of U.S. diplomats hostage in 79 and 80 to some of the actions that Hezbollah took in Lebanon and Saudi Arabia that resulted in loss of life to IEDs that killed American military personnel in Iraq. But it's helpful to also understand the grievances that Iran has against the United States. So Iran's popularly elected prime minister, who wanted to keep more of Iran's oil wealth inside the country as opposed to have the British take it out, was Mossadegh. And the CIA helped to overthrow Mossadegh and put the Shah back in power in 1953. Then during the Iran-Iraq war, a war of attrition that lasted most of the 80s, the United States provided both supplies as well as military intelligence to the Iraqis, and very importantly, looked the other way while Saddam Hussein used chemical gas against Iran, killing around 100,000 people, and the United States looked the other way. So the red line that we drew with Assad in Syria somehow didn't exist during the Iran-Iraq war because we didn't like the other side of that conflict. And then when President Khatami, who was president of Iran about 10 years ago, unilaterally halted its enrichment program, the response from President Bush at that time was to call Iran an axis of evil. So every time, from the Iranian point of view, they feel that they have taken a step, it's been rebuffed, and they feel that the United States, historically at least, has been intent on keeping Iran from having independence and alternative point of view in terms of the region, to the point that we've always looked for regime change. That's the perspective from Tehran. And so given that narrative, their point of view was they need to achieve their own security in the region. And how have they achieved their security? They've achieved that through proxies and surrogate forces in the Middle East, in regions that where there's a greater number of Shiites than Sunni. That happens to be in Lebanon, where the number of Shiites and Sunnis are about the same, with the Hezbollah unit. They've done that in Syria. And obviously Iraq has now become largely bespoken for towards Iran. So you have to step back from this complicated picture and ask the question, how can the picture be changed in a way that pushes it more towards stability? And I think at the end of the day, this is going to boil down to the United States respecting Iran's independence and recognizing its rights as a power in the region, while in return Iran acts in a responsible way to be an actor in favor of stability in the region, as opposed to feel pressured and therefore look for adventurism in terms of getting its way. This nuclear deal is going to help the reformist camp in Iran, who do want Iran to engage internationally and behave as a responsible actor in the Middle East. And it undermines the hardline elements who are deeply suspicious of international engagement and want to maintain Iran in a more isolationist state. So in the long term, I think if we think in a more subtle way, in a more nuanced way, in terms of our foreign policy towards Iran, that is what's going to result in a more stable Middle East. But if we persist on the same set of policies that we've been pursuing for the last 50 years, nothing really is going to change very much.
Let me finish this interview with one final question about Iranian Americans. Iranian Americans have been one of the most successful groups in all of America, I think only lagging behind Jewish Americans and perhaps Chinese Americans in terms of educational achievement, per capita income, all of the intellectual achievement, high degrees. What are the reasons for this tremendous success of Iranian Americans?
The most important reason, Josh, I think, is that Iranians going back thousands of years come from an entrepreneurial culture. It's, the tradition of Iran were the bazaars, where the merchants had to basically build businesses by themselves, figure out how to make ends meet and be successful in a highly competitive economic environment. That bazaar culture, I think, has created a degree of resilience for cultures of long standing, and I put Chinese and Indians and Iranians in the same category. These are all many millennia old cultures. They're used to trade. They're used to figuring out how to build a foundation for themselves. And it's not surprising that these same ethnic minorities, Indian Americans, Chinese Americans, Iranian Americans, have ended up being so successful. They haven't relied on handouts. They've had to build a life by themselves. And in the case with Iranian Americans, really after the Iranian Revolution, large numbers of them couldn't go back. They didn't have a safety net here, and they had to start from scratch. And they've been able to integrate in the fabric of American society extraordinarily well. And so many of the most successful, like Pierre Omidyar, the founder of eBay, people don't even realize that he's of Iranian descent. And I think that it's the culture, a culture of self-sufficiency and a culture of resilience that for all of these ethnic groups has resulted in their success.
Hamid Biglari, it's been a pleasure having you at Worldviews.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Josh.
You've been listening to Joshua Landis's conversation with Iranian-American financier Hamid Biglari. You can watch an extended interview with Biglari on our website, kgou.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Twitter, at WorldviewsKGOU. Worldviews is produced by KGOU together with the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. This episode was produced by myself with assistance from Brian Hardzinski. For Joshua Landis, I'm Sam Dupree.